should all have sheets here with a picture of Verlaine drawn by Fauré when Fauré visited him in hospital. And should you be interested afterwards, there are two books here that I've done. This is a French song companion, which you should buy for Graham Johnson's most wonderful notes on all the main melody composers. Also, there must be about some 100,000 poems, which I've translated. I'm afraid this retails at 40. I thought it was 30, or even as payback, but you can have it for 30. And then this is another one, the Book of Lieder, with an introduction by Ian Bostridge. This has about 1,200 poems, parallel translation, and notes on all the poets and composers. That retails at 30, and you can have it for 20. We've got 75 minutes. I've got 14 songs to play you, but I don't know whether we're going to get there or not. It comes in three parts, this lecture. Can you all hear me, because I'm not mic'd? The first is a bit of a compulsory biography. Who was Verlaine? Secondly, just a couple of minutes on his poetics, with particular reference to rhythm and rhyme. And thirdly, a discussion of 14 songs by about 8 or 9 different composers, with some rather wonderful recordings. Verlaine, I think we all know, he came from a military family, was born on the 30th of March, 1844. And having left school in 1862, he began to study law. Not long before he abandoned legal studies and became an insurance salesman, like very many other great artists who went the same route. Always something of a rolling stone, he then decided to become what he said was a poète fonctionnaire, in other words, a civil servant, and the time he got off allowed him to write poetry. His father died in 1865, and Verlaine became even closer to his mother. The next year, 1866, saw the publication at his own expense of his first great volume of poetry, the Poèmes Saturniens, which were issued at his own expense, I think only about 100 copies. The Parnassian care for form and objectivity and restraint is paid lip service to by Verlaine in this volume, but you also get a whiff of the real Verlaine, in particular in the Chanson d'Automne, and that is in your handout. It is page 3. If you just look at it quickly, there's an astonishing richness of rhyme. Les sangles longs, les vieux longs, de l'automne. And it's also this versatility with rhythm. Look at the last stanza. Je m'en vais au vent mauvais qui m'emporte de ça, de là, four syllables, pareil à là. Another four, but it sort of hangs in the air, and then all by itself, feuille morte. It's an astonishing song by Renaldo Hahn. Hahn, by the way, not Hahn, because his father was German. He lived, as you know, South America, and came to Paris when he was 11. Could we just listen to this song? It is number one. This is the real Verlaine. Thank you. François Leroux, not blessed with one of the world's greatest voices, but I love what he's done for it. All these different nuances, shadings, always considers text. How ironic that this great poem should have launched D-Day. It was the code that was announced over the wireless for the start of D-Day. So that was 1866 with Verlaine. You should have also a handout of the songs. So that was composed in 1893 by Hahn. In 1867, Verlaine visited Hugo in Brussels, and in September, he was present at Baudelaire's funeral. This is just to give you an idea of things happening in France. The great Baudelaire, not much set by melody composers, but one of the greatest of all French poets. In 1869, Lemaire published the Fête Galante, a slim volume, as rare as hen's teeth for collectors of such things, of 22 poems that opened with Clair de Lune and went on with such poems as Sur l'herbe, Les Ingenues, Fantoche, Le Faune, Mandoline, Aclimène, En Sourdine, and Couleur Sentimentale, we'll be hearing some of these, which soon reached a worldwide audience through the settings of Debussy, Ravel, Fauré, and others. 3 months after the publication of the Fête Galante, Verlaine visited the composer Charles de Sivry in Montmartre, and the visit was to change the outlook, the shape of his entire life. They were old friends, and 2 years previously, Verlaine had sung, he was a bad tenor, in a musical comedy that Sivry had written with Le Pelletier, one of Verlaine's greatest friends, a performance that had been attended by Sivry's 14-year-old half-sister, Mathilde. She began to read Verlaine's poetry, and it was probably more than mere interest in Verlaine's verse that led her to Sivry's house on the day of Verlaine's visit. Sivry introduced his half-sister to the 25-year-old composer, and Verlaine, 11 years older than Mathilde, tired perhaps of a life of debauchery, more of that in a minute, flattered that his ugliness, look at the picture that Fauré drew of him in hospital in 1891, had not repulsed the young girl, and seeing in her a heaven-sent opportunity to go straight and not attend to his homosexuality, he allowed himself to be affected by her advances. He calls her the child wife in his poems. He disappeared to Fontpoux, gave up absinthe, and wrote to Sivry asking him for Mathilde's hand. His reply gave Verlaine hope, and from that moment the idea of La Bonne Chanson was born, which was to become his wedding gift to her, just as Schumann wrote Merton for Robert Schumann. More on La Bonne Chanson later. He returned to Paris only to find that Mathilde had left the capital. She asked him to be patient, and finally, after 2 months and a flurry of letters, returned to Montmartre, and Verlaine was overjoyed. But her family now procrastinated, not convinced that a civil servant, come poet, with a history of drink-related violence, who published verse at his own expense, was the ideal match for their 16-year-old daughter. It's also an 11-year-old age difference. They became engaged, however, and the wedding was fixed for the following June. As the day approached and La Bonne Chanson, now complete, was with the printers, calamity struck. Mathilde contracted smallpox, infected her mother, and the marriage was postponed. The Franco-Prussian War was now looming, 1870 of course, and since an outbreak of hostilities would have meant conscription for all unmarried men, Verlaine quickly got married, and the marriage was celebrated on the 11th of August, 1870. It was, of course, a disaster. Another disaster was looming. The 17-year-old Arthur Rimbaud, we know him as musicians from one convention in Britain, Les Illuminations, 17-year-olds Arthur Rimbaud, having read Verlaine's Fête Galante, we'll look at those in a minute, expresses in the letter his admiration for the older poet, whose verse was so unlike that of the rather effete and orthodox Parnassians. With the letter, Rimbaud enclosed a few of his own poems. And to his former teacher, Georges Isambard, Rimbaud wrote, referring to the Fête Galante, I love this quote, "C'est fort bizarre." They're very strange, très drôle, very funny, very odd. Et vraiment, c'est adorable. They're wonderful. Verlaine invited him from Charleville, where he lived in the sticks, to Paris, and actually sent him a postal order to help defray the costs. Verlaine, at the time, was staying with Mathilde's parents in a small flat in the Rue Nicolet, and it was there that Rimbaud turned up in September 1871. You can just imagine the scene. He brought with him that astonishing poem, Le Bateau Ivre. In 1872, so a couple of years later, infatuated by Rimbaud, Verlaine abandoned Mathilde and their infant son, Georges, and accompanied the young poet to Belgium and London, where they stayed, incidentally, at 34 Howland Street, which is now where the post office tower is, where Rimbaud began Les Illuminations, and Verlaine wrote some of the Romans sans parole, which were indubitably influenced by Rimbaud's great work. After a short visit to France, they returned once more to London, where they stayed at 8 Royal College Street in Camden Town. And I visited there yesterday. The plaque is still there. It's not a blue one, because Verlaine and Rimbaud are not English. But it's the most suggestive moment. You stand outside, and that's where they stayed and made love, drank absinthe. Do go and see it. Their life together was punctuated by drunken quarrels, in the last of which, in Brussels, Verlaine fired at Rimbaud, wounding him, not in the arm, but in the wrist. 2 years of imprisonment followed for Verlaine, during which time he turned to religion and was received into the Roman Catholic Church. This conversion is the subject of many of the poems in Sagesse. You've got the dates of all the main volumes of Verlaine on the front of your sheet, which was published in 1881 and included the wonderful, which we'll hear later, Le ciel est par-dessus de toi, si bleu, si calme, de forêt cette est prison, and Hahn as d'une prison. On leaving prison, Verlaine spent nearly 2 years in English schools at Stickney in Lincolnshire, where he fell under Tennyson's spell. Tennyson, you probably know, came from Lincolnshire, and he was particularly impressed by Tennyson's morality in poems such as Idylls of the King. And also he taught at Bournemouth, where he taught French and Latin in a Catholic school. The most wonderful sketch by Max Beerbohm, I don't know whether you know, Poet's Corner, of Verlaine trying to control the school children in Bournemouth teaching French. By all accounts, he was not a very good disciplinarian. Between 1878 and 1883, he then tries his hand at farming in the Ardennes, goes to England again, tries a spell of rural life, drinks immoderately, and is imprisoned once more for attacking his widowed mother, who had been keeping house for him. Thereafter, until he died, he lived for the most time in Paris, often in hospital, where Fauré visited and drew him, as we've seen, and always dependent on public assistance for shelter. Lapses into debauchery were followed by periods of repentance. Now, musicians tend to know Verlaine as the poet of exquisitely musical verse, the laments of the poet Saturnien, the fairy tale magic, as we'll see in a minute, of the Fête Galante, the spiritual depth of Sagesse, and the poignant yearning of the Romans sans parole. We imagine him to be a sensitive romantic. Prepare for a shock. As a precocious 14-year-old, he read obscene books. By 17, he was frequenting brothels. At 18, he became addicted to absinthe, although I guess that none of us have had it. You probably know those wonderful paintings by Picasso and Degas depicting absinthe drinkers. The addiction also led to homicidal rages. Verlaine's dual nature was mirrored in his bisexuality. Homosexual activity began in his teens, and he continued to have male lovers throughout his life. After Rimbaud, his most passionate and loving relationship was with Lucien Letinois, the young man with whom Verlaine tried his hand at farming, and who he had considered adopting, and who died of typhoid fever in 1883. Verlaine's dual nature is also suggested by the title of one of his books, Parallèlement. You see the date on the front sheet. There are also three volumes of erotic poetry, all of which are explicitly and actually rather wonderfully sexual. Les Amis with an Eon, 1867, published in Brussels, is a slender volume of six lesbian sonnets. Femme, 1890, deals with Verlaine's heterosexual relationships with women and prostitutes. And Ombre, poems of male love that were written for the most part in 1891, the time when Verlaine visited him in hospital. These three volumes, often called the Trilogie Érotique, have long since been unavailable to the general reader, though there are expensive and extremely rare editions illustrated by great artists. And some of the tamer poems do appear in Parallèlement. Verlaine himself described his being as a homo duplex, a merging of opposites, a man torn between conventional moralities, we'll see in La Bonne Chanson, and the quest for freedom, torn between heterosexuality and homosexuality, between religion and sex, and as Baudelaire put it, between Satan and God. Although he played no instrument, he was actually extremely musical, just as Goethe was, by the way, not common view, but he was. Thanks to Baudelaire's critical writings, he discovered Wagner very early and became a devotee of his music. His admiration can be seen in two poems from Amour, one devoted to Ludwig II from Bavaria, and the other one is called Parsifal. He was on friendly terms with many composers, in particular Chapier, for whom he wrote two opera libretti, and he also had a hand in his masterpiece, in Chapier's masterpiece, you probably know, L'Étoile, writing, contributing to the libretto. The titles of his poems and reflect his interest in music, a bit like Eichendorff. Ballade en rêve, La Bonne Chanson, Romance sans parole, and many of the poems contain lines in which you read about musical instruments. Sangle long des violons, we just heard. Ou sont des tambourins, we're going to hear later with the flûte, the elephone. Un jouant du lutte et dansant quasi triste, and that miracle of a song, Claire de Lune. And in one famous poem, which we also hear a few times, Sur l'herbe, set by Ravel, he actually introduces notes of the scale. A very quick look at his art poétique. So that's on page 2 of your sheet. Not going to do the whole thing, it's too long. There is incidentally a setting, a wonderful setting, by Léo Ferré. I don't know whether anyone knows this parallel tradition, not of the melody, but the chanson. You probably love Jacques Brel, Georges Brassens. Well, Léo Ferré says some of the most wonderful poems of that land, including this huge art poétique. Just two things, meter. De la musique begins avant toute chose, et pour cela préfère l'impair. Well, l'impair is quite simply lines with an odd number of syllables. And this was nothing new in a way, Verlaine had also used it in the poem Saturnien. Until Verlaine, I think it's fair to say, the greatest of all French poets were technically conservative, with lines of 8, 10, and in particular the Alexandrian 12 syllables. What Verlaine did was to change the hegemony of established meters, especially the long parasyllabic line, 8, 10, 12, 14, that even Baudelaire had used, for the most part, in Les Fleurs du Mal. I think an odd number of syllables, very difficult to put your finger on, it introduces something lighter, something vaguer, something airier. He's simply making a case for irregularity of meter. In imparasyllabic meters, the caesura, the gap in the middle, will actually fall off centre. And the whole of the art poétique, if you look at it, is written in 9-syllable lines, with the caesura falling usually after the 4th syllable. So, de la musique, caesura avant toute chose. Et pour cela, préfère mon père. Now, if this is too technical, I shall stop, but I shall stop anyway. But I think it's just good to have some sort of knowledge of what Verlaine introduced into French verse. He unshackled, if I can put it like this, French versification by creating what is now known as the vers libéré, liberated verse. And he captures this fragile state between dreaming and waking, like nobody else in French literature. Secondly, rhyme. If you look at the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6th stanza, prends l'éloquence et tord-lui son cou, and then the next stanza, qui dira les torts de la rime? Well, firstly, rhyme. He's not aiming his barbs at rhyme, but aiming his barbs at flashy rhyme. Predictable rhyme, cheap rhyme, rhyme for the sake of rhyme, false and hollow. He's not suggesting that rhyme should be abandoned, and indeed most of his poetry does rhyme. His own rhymes often have a lightness and a freedom, as we've just seen in the Chanson d'Automne, de ci de la parée à la feuille morte. But I think enough of abstract poetics. What I'd like to do in the next, 50 minutes, if we've got 50 minutes or 55 minutes, is to take a chronological view, chronological from a musical point of view, of some 14 settings of Verlaine's poems. And while studying these, we will tangentially also discuss a bit about biography and poetics. So off we go. It's number one, it's track number 7 when we get there, but not quite at the moment. This was set in 1872, or actually 1871, some scholars say. It is the first setting of a Verlaine poem. It's also one of the greatest, and it's by Massenet. Now, I don't know whether you know much about Massenet songs, composed over 250 of them, rather saccharine texts, pretty much ignores the piano, knew when he was on to a winner, and his music, because the salon loved it in Paris and other towns in France, the publishers had his songs published in 5 different voices. They sold immediately, like hot cakes, and there's a wonderful picture in the Bibliothèque Nationale by a guy called Xavier Houblet, which depicts Saint-Saëns playing his songs, and there are 3 sopranos, and 1 lady in the audience, and 1 male page turner. Quite perfumed songs. There's some very good ones too. Every now and again you come across great names like Ronsard, Musset, Hugo, and of course Verlaine. But for the most part, I would suggest they're not. Can you just look at the poem? It's called actually Rêvant, c'est l'heure. It's L'heure exquise. The poem is much, much set. It's on your sheet number 3. I think we all probably know this poem. Translators often get something wrong in the penultimate line. Do I have it? Page 3. It's called L'heure exquise. It's called by Massenet, it's called Rêvant, c'est l'heure. And I think what it means, the penultimate line, a vast and tender constellation seems to fall du firmament. Last iris, and we all know that Astri means star, but it actually means any heavenly body, and here it must mean the moon. It's the most delicious song, let's listen to it. fighting to do it more often. 1871, he started writing songs mid-1860s, and they are pretty saccharine, a lot of texts in particular. He sets some poems by Armand Silvestre, the poet whom Fauré liked so much. And they are good. There's one cycle that I can recommend to you, the Poème d'Avril. It's about seven songs. It's in Graham Johnson's, my book there. Well, let's move. And by the way, that would have been published in five different keys. Seems astonishing. To Fauré and Green, a song I guess as we all know. It was Winnaretta de Polignac who unwittingly brought Fauré and Verlaine together. Winnie, as her friends called her, I don't know whether you know this, but she inherited a fortune from her father's Isaac Singer, the sewing machine manufacturer. And it was her wish to open her new music room in the Rue Cotonvert in Paris with a work specially written for the occasion by Fauré on a text of his choice. She offered him the princely sum, seems amazing, of 25,000 francs. And he suggested a collaboration with Verlaine. Negotiations began in 1891 and dragged on and on. Verlaine, if you look at the picture, the Chinese-like eyes, was a mere shadow of his former self. He had relapsed into alcoholism and was finally confined to hospital, where Fauré, as we've mentioned, went to visit and also sketch the ailing poet. Seven letters exist that were written by Verlaine to Fauré, more of that in a minute. And they're among, I think, the most pathetic letters ever written by a great poet in decline. We might read one just at the end. One dated the 6th of April, 1891, begs Fauré to persuade Winnaretta to give him an advance on the money promised him. Fauré succeeded, and Verlaine started to work on the opera that they had in mind, which is called L'Hôpital Watteau, after the painter, but nothing came of the venture, and none of the text has yet been found. Fauré, however, remained faithful to Verlaine. Though nothing came of their collaboration, Fauré, though he fulminated about Verlaine's torpor in several letters to Winnie, clearly admired the older poet, sketched him in hospital, interceded for him, as we've seen, and played the organ at Verlaine's funeral. His greatest Verlaine songs are perhaps the so-called Cinq Mélodies de Venise, although only Mandoline was actually written in Venice. The poems are Verlaine at his very best. Some of the poems we'll look at are Verlaine decidedly not at his best. Verlaine, I think, is one of the very few great poets who was not a thinker or an intellectual. His domain is his own sensations. And it's not for nothing that his admiration of Baudelaire centered on Baudelaire's obsession with spleen, melancholy, as we see in the Fleur du Mal. Fauré's Green is the third song of the Cinq Mélodies de Venise. Verlaine's title, Green, refers, just look at it, it's on page 3. Voici les fruits, les fleurs, les feuilles, et les branches, for the lovely alliteration with all those Fs, and all the commas. The green is not just, I think, refers to all those green plants, all the vegetation, but also to the poem's aura of innocence, sexual innocence. It was probably written, the poem, between October and December 1872. It describes a young man bearing gifts to his beloved, and the actual lovemaking takes place, I suggest, in the gap between stanzas 2 and 3. In stanza 2, we go from a kneeling position, and then in stanza 3, we move to a supine position of post-coital fatigue, which is so wonderfully realized by Fauré. Fauré's setting, not so much in this recording, with Gérard Suzet, is all breathlessness, which explains why the composer wrote to Marguerite Bonny In the case of Green, I cannot too strongly recommend to you not to sing it slowly. Its nature is lively, passionate, almost breathless. Above all, sing it for yourself alone. Well, I don't know what you feel about what the Germans call Werktäuer. If something is marked slow, do you have to sing it slow? I feel very strongly that there's no point in telling students, for example, to sing song like Nacht und Träume very slowly if they can't do it. And it seems to me that you can actually attain the atmosphere that is required by poet and composer by doing it really rather differently from the metronome marking. Probably divides us down the middle of this, but I feel very strongly that that is the case. This is Gérard Souzet, accompanied by Jacqueline Bonneau, and those of you who collect recorded sound will know that up to about 1970, when he was with Jacqueline Bonneau, the recordings are so wonderful, open-voiced. And then, when he's with Dalton Baldwin, from about 1970 onwards, something's happened to the voice. It's no longer the same open, full-throatedness. A bit like Schwarzkopf, you know, pre-1953. And then afterwards, it becomes nasalized and vowels distorted and so on. I think it's the most wonderful thing we can play.
Voici les familles, les fleurs, les feuilles et les romans.
Two exceptions, the wonderful La Lune Blanche, which we just heard, and the miraculous Avant que tu ne t'en ailles. Anyway, Fournier chose 9 of these poems and set the first 8 poems of 1892 to 3, and it was not until a year later that he finished them with L'hiver a cessé. And it was premiered on the 20th of April 1895 by Jeanne Remarque and Fournier, and was received with bewilderment by the critics, who complained especially about the difficulty of the music and the endless modulations. Saint-Saëns was shocked by the formal and harmonic novelty of the cycle, and according to Proust, Debussy didn't care for it either. Proust himself, however, adored the work and considered it infinitely superior to the earlier songs. If you just look at the text on page 4, you see what I mean by sort of banality. J'allais par les chemins perfides, you know, referring to his relationship with Rimbaud, debauchery. Douloureusement incertain, vos chères mains furent mes guides. It's all too respectable somehow. And there are worse ones, but I've chosen this one. And she says to him, he says, marche encore, walk straight through life. So orthodoxly, moderately, and you'll be very happy. Greatness in poetry is very often not like that. One or two things about the setting. This first line, the treacherous ways, they're wonderfully illustrated in Fauré's anguished harmonies and the chromaticism of the beginning. And at vos chères mains furent mes guides, we hear much more consoling music. And then there's a magical modulation. While the melody is traced by the pianist's right hand, the left hand climbs seraphically up the stave, and they meet just as the two lovers meet. This is number, yes. CD. You can still get it, I think, on EMI Référence. We now hear Felicity Lott accompanied by Graham Johnson. This extraordinary song uses the simplest of means to achieve its effect. An accompaniment, you'll hear, that starts deep in the bass and rises hypnotically to the upper reaches of the keyboard. The vocal melody is really hardly a melody at all. It's more like a recitation. There is a telling modulation in the interlude, and I think wonderful the way that the voice soars a sixth at Ubiani Ni. Calm returns in the second strophe, the voice climbs a dénouement, then descends into the depths for C'est l'heure. The calm is increased in the third verse, and then the singer, one of the most wonderful moments in the entire history of the melody, unaccompanied, soars a seventh for C'est l'heure exquise. It's only a D sharp, but it sounds stratospherically high. You probably have experienced with your own students, something very difficult to do unaccompanied. And I think the astonishing thing about this song is the way in which Hahn uses not just melody and harmony, but silence. He's one of the great masterpieces of the French repertoire. Same time he demanded money. Verlaine fired two shots at Rambaud. One entered the left wrist. It was removed 3 days later. Verlaine had probably, I think, not wished to wound his lover, who was 18. And when Verlaine's mother bandaged the wound, the two poets actually walked together to the station, began another argument, and Rambaud, when Verlaine seemed to reach for his gun, appealed to a policeman who was passing by, who arrested Verlaine as he brandished the revolver. He was sentenced, as you've heard, to 2 years solitary confinement, at first at the Prison des Petits Carmes and then in Mons jail, where he reconverted, as we've seen, to Catholicism. He was allowed to exercise in a prison yard from where he could see a poplar tree. He was released in January 1875 with time off for good behavior, and he had served only 18 months of his sentence. If you just turn to the last sheaf of your little handout, I find this so tantalizing. This is the autograph copy of the poem that Verlaine wrote in prison. It hasn't come out very well on the sheet, but it's in a school exercise book. Well, the poem was published in Sagesse under a Catholic imprint, interestingly enough. Fauré's prison, the prison, dates from 1894, and it's the last of his 16 Fauré settings. The key is the melancholy E flat minor, and the melody is one of his most sparse and austere. Marked quasi adagio, the accompaniment just limps along to a succession of staccato crotchets with the voice singing piano until the terrible realization that the poet's full life has been wasted and ruined, which occasions a forte outburst of mon Dieu, mon Dieu. The vocal line rises a single semitone. It's one of those examples in song where a single semitone can make all the difference. I was coaching with Veronica in Aberystwyth early on last week, and one of the singers, very good singer, sings Leiter 1. And we actually got her when she says, Dort, Dort, wo hohe Mauern blühen, my beloved will come. Rises just a semiquaver. It's one of the great magical moments, and she got it. Just a semiquaver here, just a semitone, but it's devastating in its effect. And then it's followed by a gradual decrescendo in the final 7 bars from P to PP to PPP as he reflects despairingly on the loss of his youth. Let's hear it. This is again a Gérard Souzé and Jacqueline Bonham. Does anyone have the time? I guess we're not going to get to the... How much time have we got?
16 minutes.
Let's skip. Let's turn to Debussy. When we sing Al Travers, this wonderful young song that he composed when he was quite young, Un Grand Son et Noir, also set by Stravinsky and Honegger, which I was going to play you. Also the Ernest Chausson, La Chanson bien douce. But for many of us, these three songs from the second book of the Fête Galante are some of the greatest songs in all French song. So we're talking now about Les Ingénues. So this is on page 6. Les Ingénues, Le Folle and Colloque Sentimental. What was it? This is a question not very often asked, that made Verlaine write about all these marquis and marquises, the fête galante of the 18th century, the Pierrot and the Colombine. Well, Edmond Le Pelletier, Verlaine's lifelong friend, who saw the Romans sans parole through the press when Verlaine was languishing in prison, suggests three influences. The publication by Edmond and Jules Goncourt of several studies of 18th century dealing with the life and adventures of great actresses. Apparently it had an astonishing effect when it was first published. Secondly, the opening. I think this is actually more relevant. The opening of the Galerie Lacaze in the Louvre, which displayed paintings by Fragonard, Watteau, Lancret, Greuze, and so on. All these poems you see represented in their paintings. But also, there's this poem by Victor Hugo, which if you just read, it is, you have it here, no, I don't think I put it. Yes, you do, it's on the bottom of the page.
Page five,
yes, bottom page 5. Although it's in parasyllabic lines, in other words, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 syllables, 12 actually here, you can see the effect that it had on Verlaine. Il sentit par de graisse mêlée à leur âme, à leur discours secret, à leur regard de flamme, à leur cœur, à leur sens, à leur molle raison, le clair de lune bleue qui baignait l'horizon. This was a very famous poem. And I think this is one of the reasons that Verlaine wrote the 22 poems of the Fête Galante. Well, let's look at them. They are astonishing, these songs. And then we'll close. They were published in 1904, so in the 20th century, 13 years after Debussy's first set. And it marks the breakup of his marriage and the beginning of his liaison with Emma Bardac, who was also Fauré's mistress. Not surprisingly, it expresses much greater disenchantment than the first set of Fête Galante, especially in Le Folle and Le Colloque Sentimental. The collection starts with Les Ingénues. Now, traditionally, as you know, an ingénue is a woman, a naive girl. But here it's not spelled with an E, and we're dealing with young men who are ready to be seduced by women. The poem is about flirting and frolicking, but Debussy, with a touch of genius, slows the rhythm in the final line and infuses the song with a depth of feeling that I think is absent from the poem. And then the Folle. It's characterized, as you know, by this ostinato drum bass marked très lointain and very distant, and sans nuance, without nuance, but very rhythmically. The drumming starts in bar 4 and continues to the end, a sort of fate motif that warns the lovers of an unhappy end to these moments of content. I don't know whether you know the recording of Maggie Tate with Alfred Couture. He must put something on the dampers of the piano because it makes a sort of thud sound. Quite extraordinary. Couture had great touch. He couldn't have done that. He must have meddled with his piano. Very effective it is, in order to simulate the sound of the tambourine. And then finally, Colloque Sentimental, arguably the greatest song in the entire repertoire. a dialogue between two ghostly figures who recall their lost love. The first lover still burns with passion, and Debussy sets his words to a rich texture that contrasts vividly the plain choral style of the disenchanted lover. Their conversation is framed by the narrator, who begins and ends the song with spare recitative that recalls Schubert's Der Doppelgänger. Despite the intensity of these emotions, the voices never ever once rise above piano, and the overwhelming melancholy of this masterpiece is highlighted by the long, insistent A-flat pedal in the bass. Well, who are these people? Man and woman? Two men? Two women? Knowing of Verlaine's proclivities, it could be any of these. The first performance was given at Madame Edouard Colomb's final Thursday musical on the 23rd of June 1904 with Debussy at the piano, and he dedicated to ALPM. Scholars racked their brains for years to find out what that meant. It emerged some time ago, à la petite mienne. So my darling little woman, girl, so I'm referring to Emma Van Dyke. Let's hear them, they're wonderful.
Thank you. possibly all we have time for, when I was preparing this talk, I did some research on numbers, and at least 650 composers have set Verlaine. From America, in alphabetical order, Argentine, Austria, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, Finland, Great Britain, Germany, Holland, Hungary, Italy, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Dean Rupati, wonderful songs, Russia, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Czechoslovakia, Turkey, and Yugoslavia, and amongst some of my heroes, Paul Dessau and Max Heger from Germany, Josef Marx and Karl-Heinz Stockhausen from Germany, from Austria, Carpenter and Charles Loeffler from America, Frederick Delius and Vaughan Williams, both of whom set Le Ciel et Papa sur le Toit, wonderful songs from England, Alphonse Diepenbrock, another great composer of Verlaine from Holland, Alfredo Casella and Riccardo Zandonai, his Francesco Verini is on in London at the moment at Holland Park, Dino Lepati from Romania, and Honegger and Schoep from Switzerland. Anyway, I hope that it's broadened just a few horizons. If you are interested in those books, the orange one is £30 and the other one is £20, £10 discount on each. Thank you.